Good evening. Good evening. My name is Paul Holdengraber, and I'm the Director of Public Programs here at the New York Public Library, known as Live from the New York Public Library. As all of you have heard me say many times, my goal here at the library is to make the lions roar, to make a heavy institution dance, and when successful, to make it levitate. It's a great pleasure to have Stephen Johnson back for, I think, the third or fourth or fifth time. It's always a pleasure to have him back. He's often been here in the role of moderator, though he's not particularly moderate. And today what I would like is for him to be in the hot seat, actually for Sherry Turkle and for Stephen Johnson to be both in the hot seat. What I would love is for them to have a conversation, obviously, but also to, if possible, they will make me happy if they goad each other. I don't exactly know what they will be speaking about, which makes me even happier. So we will now witness live a conversation between Stephen Johnson and Sherry Turkle. Stephen Johnson just wrote a book, which he will be signing after the event, called Future Perfect: The Case for Progress in a Networked Age. And Sherry Turkle wrote a book called Alone Together: Why We Expect More from Technology and Less from Each Other. You may know that over the last few years, I've been asking the various guests I bring here for a biography in seven words, something that either defines them or doesn't define them at all in seven words. A haiku of sorts, or if one is in the company of Sherry Turkle or Stephen Johnson, a tweet. And this is what Sherry Turkle sent to me. Actually, she sent me, first of all, she sent me 12 words, and then I reminded her that I wanted seven. So why don't I read the long version first? Technology doesn't just change what we do, it changes who we are. And then, when I reminded her I wanted seven words, I think she wrote eight. Brooklynite in Boston, mother, studies people and objects. Stephen Johnson was much more careful because he gave me seven words: writer, maker, dad, optimist, temporary Californian, which might mean that he may grace us with his presence back in New York now that he lives in California. I think the evening will happen as follows. They will both present to you their thoughts, and then they will debate those thoughts with you. And then you will have occasion to ask them questions. We will end at 8:30 or 8:29, so that after the book signing, you can rush back home and look at what we also hope will be a debate.
Hello. Thank you all for coming out. Yeah, apparently there is this other debate tonight. I didn't realize. Apparently there's this presidential election. So we're on a very strict clock here because I know everyone wants to hear the zingers. Here's what we're going to do. Just to reiterate what Paul said, I'm going to goad Sherry by checking my email throughout the evening, compulsively. we're gonna spend about 10 minutes each kind of talking about the respective arguments of our books, and then have a conversation, the two of us, and then have a few minutes for conversation with you, and then sign, if that's all right with all of you. Thank you for coming out. So let me jump in with the argument of this new book, Future Perfect. This is, as Paul alluded to, it's an optimistic book. It's trying to make the case for a new kind of political worldview or sensibility that I see around me in a lot of people and projects that I've kind of come to admire over the years. It involves a lot about technology, but I've tried hard in the book to not have it strike a purely kind of cyber utopian tone for reasons that I'm sure we'll get into. But the argument basically involves a couple of layers here. Let me just try and go through those layers quickly. The first is this. We have these institutions in our lives that we more or less kind of take for granted in terms of the definitions of them. So we talk about, you know, the role of government in society, we talk about the role of corporations, we talk about the role of the market. And in many ways, our basic core political worldviews are structured around the relative kind of ratios of those institutions and how we think they should kind of share the kind of responsibilities in society. So if we're on the left, we think that the government should have a bigger role. If we're on the right, we think that the market should be unleashed and not, you know, kind of the regulators of the state and its way, and so on. So the first part of the argument is that there is another kind of organization that deserves to be part of our kind of conventional political vocabulary and deserves a lot more credit for the progress that we do see around us. And that sounds somewhat utopian, but in fact is not utopian because of the practical successes that we've seen, particularly in recent years. And that is what I'm calling the peer network, modified from kind of the peer-to-peer network that we talk about in technology. And a peer network is a kind of decentralized, distributed, diverse network of collaboration, usually without traditional kind of ownership relationship to the ideas and products that are created in that collaboration, where people are coming together to solve problems and building on each other's ideas, refining each other's ideas, shooting down each other's ideas, and collaboratively building interesting, positive things that make society better. Now, the wonderful thing that we have right now in our particular situation is that we can look now to the success of the internet, to the success of the web, to the success of Wikipedia, to the success of all the open source software that is behind so many of the devices that we use today, all of which was built effectively by peer networks. The government funded early research into the internet and was important in that, but the actual kind of people who were collaborating and building these systems were almost all working outside of traditional government agencies. They were working much more in the peer review tradition of kind of academic science. They were working in universities or at think tanks, and they created these things that miraculously no one owns, that did not evolve through traditional either top-down government initiatives or kind of bottom-up market corporate initiatives, but came out of this kind of mass collaboration. Now, I moved to Northern California. If we were having this conversation 40 years ago, and I said to you, there is this form of collaboration where people get together with diverse backgrounds and create products without traditional ownership relationships, you would all nod and say, that sounds great on your Mendocino, California commune. I think that's a wonderful idea. And the baskets that you're going to weave are going to be beautiful. We'd love to see them. But you would also have said, that's just a pipe dream. That's not something, you know, if we're trying to build something big, you need either the kind of the force of the state or, you know, the private sector energies of a big corporation. Well, now we can point to these things that have been built and that states and corporations rely on, and we can say that is not true. There are other ways to collaborate that are out there that are just as powerful. So that's step one. Peer networks work in the real world. Step two is they don't necessarily have to involve technology, and they don't necessarily have to involve solving problems that are largely about technology. So the success of Kickstarter, which is a technology, but it's trying to solve the problem using a peer network of funders of how do you get creative people to be able to finish their work? How do you fund creative work that is not yet being supported by the marketplace? Well, Kickstarter said the world is filled with people who might want to contribute $5 or $50 or $100 to an interesting creative project just for the love of it, not to make an investment in it, not to see a return on their investment, but because they, you know, they want to see this thing in the world. And as most of you probably know now, Kickstarter is on track to distribute more money than the entire budget of the National Endowment of the Arts. And it's just 3 or 4 years old, right? So that's a peer network approach to the problem of kind of encouraging creative work. But there's also face-to-face, entirely low-tech forms of peer networks. So there's a wonderful tradition out of Brazil, out of Porto Alegre, Brazil, of what we call participatory budgeting, which is actually now being experimented with in Brooklyn. And participatory budgeting started in 1989 and 1990 in Porto Alegre, and it involved neighborhood kind of councils getting together to talk about what the priorities are in their neighborhood, trying to figure out, you know, do we need the sewer extended here? Do we want the electricity grid brought here? Do we want another room for the playground or another room for the schoolhouse, whatever it is? And the neighbors create a ranked list of priorities, and then taxpayer dollars from the state are then dispersed to fund those projects. And what it created was an immediate reduction in the corruption and waste in the system, because people were there, they saw what they asked for, and when that sewer system extension didn't show up, 6 months later, they were like, we asked for this, the money was, you know, allocated for this, why isn't it here? It was much harder for kind of dollars to just disappear in the system. And people had that positive kind of feedback, again, which is based on the kind of face-to-face encounter they had with their neighbors, of they asked for something and it was actually built. And so they decided to participate more, and you had this kind of culture of civic participation that emerged. So the decision of what to fund was coming from these peer networks of neighbors forming in these communities. And we've seen, actually, you know, a great example of that in New York in the 311 system that we've kind of pioneered here in New York, which is one of the great success stories in the last 10 or 20 years of kind of managing cities. And what 311 does, as many of you know, is basically, you know, it enables anyone who has can dial three numbers on a phone to help report problems or suggest kind of unmet needs in the city and ask questions. So anybody can say, hey, our school's closed today, there's a pothole on my street, the bar down the street is making too much noise, I need this service, you know, can you provide it for me? And what makes it so important is that the city takes in all that information and has this kind of dashboard that is able to track all these emerging problems and, in fact, identify needs among their citizens that they hadn't anticipated. And so what it does is effectively it creates this extended peer network of ordinary folks who are not on the payroll of the government, who are helping the government solve its problems and be more adaptable, more flexible, more innovative in the services that it offers and its ability to kind of meet the needs of its citizens. And there's a great, just one quick story that some of you probably experienced that's in the book. It's one of my favorite stories from the book. A few years ago, there was this bizarre thing where certain neighborhoods in Manhattan would start to smell like maple syrup. Do people experience this? So you'd be walking, it would be on the west side of Manhattan, you'd be walking down the street, and all of a sudden, you know, West Chelsea would smell just like pancakes. And people were, you know, kind of baffled by this, and they're walking around like, why does the whole neighborhood smell like this? And so 311 had just started, and people started to call in to say, is this maybe a chemical attack? You know, this is, the whole neighborhood smells like this. This is post-9/11 New York. Is it like the Aunt Jemima wing of Al-Qaeda that has somehow attacked us? And so they called in, and, you know, the city had no idea what was going on, and so they sent out people to test the air. The air was fine, so they told people not to worry. It kept happening. And it kept happening so much that the city began to call these things maple syrup events, MSE, capital M, capital S, capital E. It's like the worst thriller you've ever gone to, the maple syrup event. And for years this went on until finally the city realized, wait a second, we have all these calls that we've recorded in our kind of dashboard. These are clues. And so they went back and they looked at all the different MSEs that had broken out, and they overlaid basically the weather patterns for each outbreak, and particularly looked at the wind patterns for each day. And when they analyzed all that data, it created this vector that pointed straight back to this very clear point in New Jersey. There were nice smells coming from there. I'm not complaining about the smells. And they drove their kind of city van across the bridge and went to this exact point where they found this artificial flavor and smell processing plant that every now and then processed the fenugreek seed, which is used in cheap maple syrup knockoffs in American supermarkets. The beautiful thing about this story is it was not life or death. It was not a chemical attack, thank God. But when they were designing the 311 service, nobody said, you know, this service should be really good at detecting syrupy smells and figuring out their points of origin, right? It was not part of the spec. But because they greatly extended and diversified the network of people who could contribute to the system and who could be eyes and ears on the street for the city, they were able to kind of solve this completely unanticipated problem that they you know, hadn't kind of imagined in advance. And that's the power of these kinds of systems, is that they're much more resilient and flexible and innovative than a lot of kind of traditional top-down systems. So the book is trying to make the argument that there are a lot of new ways that we can approach problems using this kind of approach, and it's basically making the case that if you believe in these systems, you don't quite fit the model of either existing political party. You're not a big champion of top-down big government, and you're not just a kind of free market libertarian. You believe in a different kind of institution as the kind of one of the most promising tools that we have at our disposal. So I've started calling these people, to try and give them a name, I've started calling them pure progressives. They believe in progress, they come out of the progressive tradition, but they're optimistic, and they believe in the power of these peer networks to solve problems. So I think there's a lot of other examples of how this is working in practice. If you get a chance to read the book, I hope you'll enjoy checking it out. That's my spiel. Sure.
Well, I listened to an interview with Stephen in which he said that Future Perfect was provocatively utopian. And my book, Alone Together, has often been described as provocatively pessimistic. And I think of these two books taken as a kind of matched set. Maybe you could think of them as the yin and yang of our moment, because I think they raise the question of really how to approach where we are now. Stephen said that he writes in this optimistic vein, because I think he is telling an optimistic story, and a story that in many ways I agree with, because he wants to find a way to steer us forward. And I want to find a way to steer us forward too. But I'm writing with a different sense of what's called for now. I'm writing basically, I don't think it's a pessimistic book, but it's a cautionary tale. Because I am writing a cautionary tale because I began my life, and this is the story I want to tell you about Alone Together, is Alone Together is kind of a book of repentance, because I began my life as a cyber diva. I began my life writing about this subject on the cover of Wired magazine as sort of somebody who was there writing about the wonderful new identity possibilities of online life, stressing how online we could experiment with identity and explore aspects of self that we couldn't really in the physical world, and really make something of that, take what we learned about ourselves in the virtual and to live better lives in the physical real. And all of that is still true. All of that is still true, but there was something that I didn't see when I wrote Life on the Screen 15 years ago and got to play Cyber Diva for a couple of years. And what I didn't see was that when we had our devices for going into virtual space always on and always on us, the little devices that, you know, you all kind of politely silenced to sit down and listen to us, the devices that we're always worried we forgot to silence. Stephen and I just did an interview, and both of us were, you know, had our phones vibrating in our back. You know, that when we had these devices on us, we would be constantly tempted to be elsewhere all the time. When I wrote Life on the Screen in 1995, during my cyber diva phase, my model of how we would do this identity play was that we would sit at our computers, we would do our identity play, then people got up, they lived in the real world, they profited from their identity play in the real, in kind of the quote, real physical world. Then later they sat down at their computers again and had their identity play, and then they put it away and they got up and they lived with their families and their friends and their partners. And now, well, you know what's happening now. My research over the past 15 years is that parents sit at breakfast and dinner texting while their kids are sitting at breakfast and dinner texting. The children are complaining of not having their parents' full attention. The parents are kind of spacing out, not paying attention to their kids. They're sitting in the park. Their kids are on the jungle gym begging for their parents' attention. The parents are texting and doing their calls. Moms are pushing strollers, not talking to their children. Children are now silent in their strollers as the moms have hundreds of hours of film of moms pushing strollers, not talking to their children while they're busy on their phones. Moms sort of texting, paying no attention to their children as they're breastfeeding. People texting at funerals, this is very big, it's a big part of my study. I ask people why, they tell me funerals are boring. They're right. But there were reasons that we didn't text at funerals. There were reasons that we didn't text at funerals. And that had to do with where people will say, well, I text during the boring bits. This is a very important new theme. But there were reasons we didn't text at funerals. We didn't text at funerals because we were showing the other people who were there and our children who we often brought with us that we were members of a community. It wasn't just about the interesting bits and the boring bits. I study corporate meetings. People text during corporate meetings. People text during classes. People text during presentations. People text during all meetings. I teach a course on memoir at MIT, I mean, just to take last semester. And halfway through the course, some of the kids in the class came up to me and said, we want to talk about the class because we're texting under the desks and we kind of don't think it's right because in this memoir class, people kind of sharing the stories of their lives. It's a very intimate class and people are talking about their lives. And why were these kids texting? And they said some really interesting things. It really wasn't because they were, you know, they weren't shopping or they weren't on Facebook. They were texting because they just wanted to know who wanted them. They wanted to know who was reaching out to them. And I hear that story not just from kids. This is not a story about young people or the new generation or digital natives. I hear the story from I was going to say older people, but not older people. I mean, just people who didn't grow up sleeping with their smartphones. That's what I'm calling older people. I mean, it's really a story that goes across generations. So this whole... I talk to people at corporate boards and I say, well, why are you texting? And basically, unapologetically, people say, well, you know, I consider myself a member of a tribe of one, and I know what's best for my tribe. And that's starting to be a very appealing position for a lot of people, this whole tribe of one story. This other story, people talk to me, this is one of my favorite things, people talk to me about the importance of making eye contact with people while you're texting. You know, how hard it is, but, you know, that this is like a new social skill. And at first I thought they were joking, and then there was a whole episode of Parks and Recreation that was about one of the main characters, you know, trying to learn this skill. My students talk about it, and I realize that they're doing it. Because in order to be in this class without my knowing that they were texting, they had to be learning to do it. So I would just say, first, that, you know, in order for these wonderful associations that we're talking about to happen, you know, people at first, you know, yes, this is happening, but something else is happening at the same time. And I think that, you know, in the kind of yin and yang dialogue that I would like to have happen, it isn't a question of negating that this is happening, but somehow to take the measure and the potential cost of something else that's happening that I'm calling a flight from conversation. Because in interview after interview, I mean, I do my own interviewing and I do my own transcription, so I can hear what people are saying and hear the tone of voice, and that the phrase that I hear over and over and over is, I'd rather text than talk. I'd rather text than talk. And I ask people, what's wrong with conversation? And people say, I'll tell you what's wrong with conversation. It takes place in real time and you can't control what you're going to say. It takes place in real time and you can't control what you're going to say. And that is what's wrong with conversation. And it also is profoundly what's right with conversation. So what people do is that when you do a Facebook profile or when you send an email or when you send a text, you get to compose yourself, you get to edit the face, the voice, the flesh, the body. You get to sort of perfect either the profile or the email or the text, and you get to present the self you want to be. And that's a sort of new, safer way to present yourself and to be. I call it the Goldilocks effect. You know, those of you who've read my work, you know, not too much, not too close, you know, just right. But I'm arguing that there is a cost to presenting yourself according to this Goldilocks effect with everything just right, because we're moving from conversation to mere connection. And just to close, you know, I was on Stephen Colbert, and on, you know, when he takes this persona of this right-wing kind of host and political host, and he said to me, but hey, don't all these little sips of online connection add up to one big gulp of real conversation? Because I was arguing that this flight from conversation was really interfering with our capacity for true dialogue, because you know, I think that we can show each other and have certain kinds of understandings in these little sips, but we're missing out on certain things. And I ended up feeling, no, that the little sips don't really add up. That there are certain things you can do with the little sips. You can share information, you can organize in certain ways, but that there's a kind of profound understanding and listening and nuanced understanding that you need to have a tolerance for ambiguity and a tolerance for sort of sitting still and being aware and taking the place of the other, that you can't have a generation growing up saying things like, and this is a direct quote, someday soon, but certainly not now, not until I'm much older, I want to learn how to have a conversation. And that is the kind of comment that I'm getting from interviewing hundreds and hundreds of young people who show up at work with earphones, So I'm looking forward to a dialogue in which we sort of talk about all of the, right. I deny, you know, in other words, this isn't a sort of, you know, that Saturday Night Live, you know, Jane, you ignorant slut.
You promised you would not call me a slut at all.
What was that Saturday Night Live
Jane,
thing?
It was Jane
Curtin.
We're not doing that.
We're not, you know, we don't disagree on as far, you know, as far as I loved Stephen's book. I think there's so many exciting things that are happening. But other things are happening too. And I think it's very important to be vigilant and to, you know, learn how to take, you know, the full measure of the complexity of the times that we live in. And my perspective on Stephen's work is, for all this good stuff to happen, and maybe this is where we can begin, for this good stuff to happen, people need to talk to each other.
Yeah. Well, I think that's wonderfully put. And say two things about Sherry's work. One, it's the ethnographic research she does is tremendous, and it's so easy to be kind of a technology theorist and just kind of dream up stuff. But you have just incredible stories in this book. and in all your work, and it's a wonderful thing. And the other thing I love about this book is that the repentance side of it. That, I mean, it's always so interesting when intellectuals kind of go back and talk about what they got wrong or what they missed. I think that as an intellectual kind of mode, it's a really interesting, striking thing. We need more of it in society. And so it's a wonderful book on that level as well. So here's a couple, let me try and push back a little bit. And somewhat you preempted me with Stephen Colbert there. I'm a little bit concerned that my argument was a bit like Colbert's, but it's a friend of mine who's here, I think, my old friend Eric Lifton, told me this story the other day about his son. They were calling, he's got a 13-year-old son, and they were calling Grimaldi's Pizza in Brooklyn to order pizza, and it's a very popular place, and it's often busy, the phone. So they sometimes call on two phones to try and get through, and his son is calling, and he kind of looks over. At a certain point, he's like, "Dad, the phone is making a weird noise. It's broken." And he's like, "What?" And he picks up the phone, and it's a busy signal. And his son had just never heard a busy signal. Everything went to voicemail, or you got a human, or you were texting. And so the whole, it was just a kind of crazy thing. And the whole idea that somehow, there would be technology that says, no, you cannot even leave a message for this person. They're busy. They're doing something else. The response of that generation was, the phone is broken. Something's not working here. And so there, I can see that very powerfully, and I certainly feel it in my own life and the pull towards constantly checking Twitter or checking my email. But the experiment I always like to do when thinking about technology, and I did this a little bit in my book, Everything Bad is Good for You, is just as a thought experiment, what would happen if it went in reverse? And the technology that we have now, the new technology, actually was the old technology, and we'd been texting each other and emailing each other and living in this world for so long, and then somehow there was a new innovation that enabled, phone calls or face-to-face conversations for the first time. How would we perceive the change? What would we miss? What would be the loss in that kind of reverse scenario? And I think the thing that I would miss the most, and it may just be the kind of necessary trade-off of these things, but I think it's powerful, and it relates to what the peer networks are all about in Future Perfect, is that amazing thing that I now have these days where I kind of touch the minds of hundreds of people. And I get these little snippets from people that I follow on Twitter, who I never will meet, but that are passing around little observations or often links to things that they're reading, which are much longer than the 140 characters, and then all the email that's flowing through my life and the texts that I get. I don't get a lot of texts, and I'm not really on Facebook. But, every day there are some, small and large bits of information that are coming from literally, more than 100 people, and many of whom are not in my kind of immediate circle. And so it's greatly extended and diversified the kind of the range of information that's flowing through my life. And it's very distracting. And it is, I can feel it when I try and sit down and read a book. And I love books. And
I thought this is what you'd miss.
No, I'm saying I do feel the cost of it.
Oh, I see. I do feel the cost of it. This is the thing you'd miss.
Well, I'm saying that I do recognize that there are costs to that widened connection, but I so cherish that kind of diversity of voices or messages that are coming through my life. And the other side of it that's interesting is, if we'd been having this conversation 20 years ago, we'd have been talking about how we would have been having the Neil Postman conversation about how you wouldn't, because you were ahead of everybody on this, but most of us would have been saying we live in the television age. And this is the rise of the image and the death of the word, and nobody's really interested in text and in thinking through language anymore. It's all this image-based society because television is the dominant kind of communications medium of our time. And so as a literary person, as a writer, the fact that we have a generation that now thinks and communicates through text so much of their time and through the various different kind of advantages you get from that, I think there are, while some of that is bite-sized text and 140 characters text, there's something encouraging about the kind of dominance or the resurgence of the written word in that story as well. Does that make any sense?
Yeah. Well, I have a couple of comments. In terms of what you'd miss, 20 years ago, I knew many people who read 3 or 4 foreign newspapers a day as just part of their normal diet to understand in depth what people, now it wasn't everyday people. Mm-hmm. In other words, you could argue you're touching lightly kind of, you know, mm-hmm. a wider variety of people, not just journalists. Right. But it used to be fascinating. I mean, when I was in college, I read Italian, French, and British newspapers every day because that's what somebody who was majoring in government and social studies did, who really wanted to understand in depth how people were really thinking about complicated things in other parts of the world. Now, you could say, well, you're getting more about, you know, from picking up the Twitter sphere about, but you have to, very few people do that now.
Mm. I would actually argue that there is more, certainly the English language international coverage.
Yeah.
I mean, I felt that after 9/11, mm-hmm. that The Guardian was much more of a presence in the political conversation because it was available online.
Online.
And so people are, and you know, I've got, this book is coming out in the UK right this week, and I know all these reviews and kind of excerpts are going to be circulating mm-hmm. just because someone will find the link and they'll put it on Twitter and people will read it.
No, but my question is different. My question has to do with how much are you feeling? I thought your point was different. How much are you feeling? And how much are Americans really feeling by what they're picking up?
Right.
And a profound, the way Italians are looking at the world.
Mm. Right.
And I don't think much.
Right, right.
I don't think Americans are following British politics much. Despite the fact that they have these, you know, the Twitter sphere is telling them maybe what the best place to get a latte. I mean, I'm astounded that my British friends will report on like the best place to get a latte in Heathrow is. But I mean, that's the first point I want to make about that. Also, I mean, I balance what you're saying, which I have a lot of respect for, the sense of having your finger out there, you know, kind of getting that sense, with what it means when I interview a young woman who says to me, I want to be in touch with my friend. I'm gonna G-chat. I'm gonna tweet him. I'm gonna send a G-chat. I'm gonna send a text, and I say, well, why not talk to him? I mean, he lives in the same dorm, so this is a student, and we're talking about why she would rather send a text than go over literally 50 feet and knock on his door, and she cannot articulate a reason why she would be missing anything by sending the text rather than having the face-to-face conversation. So one of my concerns about conversation and connection is that we sort of start to forget what the difference between them is. Mm. So I think the thing that I miss most, what I fear, what I worry about, in this move from conversation to connection, is I worry that people forget what the difference is between conversation and connection. We start to think that the sips are like the real gulp. Mm. We start to think that having a sense of what a lot of people are doing and a lot of people are thinking is the same as having a profound understanding of what their, the state of their heart. So I have nothing against, you know, what you get from Twitter. But I worry that we start to put less value on what we used to get from conversation. And certainly for younger people, I believe that's something worrying.
What's the mechanism for dealing with these issues, right? Is it, I mean, you've done this wonderful thing where you've written a book. You're out there as a kind of public intellectual talking about these things. Mm-hmm. But is it something that the technology can help solve if we understand these kind of tendencies better? Is it something that is that schools should be solving? What's how do we kind of counteract this tendency?
Well, the first thing that has to happen is that families have to not text at dinner and have to talk. I mean, I think that this really begins with a culture in the family where people start to have conversations at dinner. I mean, I say this really seriously. There's a kind of, in my view, there's a sacred space where you talk again at the dinner table, and you teach your children that it is very important to talk at the dinner table. Because the thing, I mean, my training is, I mean, you know, Steve and I really are talking in different registers, I mean, in, you know, about similar subjects, but coming at it from different points of view. My training is as a developmental and clinical psychologist. So for me, why do I care about conversation? The thing about conversation with other people is you learn how to have conversations with yourself. And so the cost of not having conversation is a cost and an ability is in self-reflection. So conversation at the dinner table is where a conversation, all those mothers pushing strollers who are now silent, all those playgrounds on the swing where the mother is pushing the swing and doing the texting with the other hand instead of talking to their child, all of these are missed opportunities for children to understand what it is to reflect and self-reflect. So I think it isn't the fault of the technology at all. Mm. So I think we can all have our phones and all say, but these phones are not meant to shut us down in this precious human gift that we have of talking to each other. I mean, I live on the summers. I have a beautiful little cottage on Cape Cod. I'm so fortunate. I walk the dunes that Thoreau walked, and you know, people used to walk these dunes, you know, looking at the sun, the sky, the beach, and heads up, you know, and now they walk like this, you know, thumbs, you know, even when they're with a child, they're like thumbs down, and you know, it's like look up, look at each other and start the conversation. I mean, it is about saying that we value this as human beings. So I'm completely convinced that this can start with people, but making a decision that this is something we value among ourselves.
Thoreau would have killed on Twitter, though, because he had this nice little aphorism that would have worked out really well. The you know what? One of the things that I was thinking when I was reading the book this last week is reading Alone Together is that one of the things that's similar, I think, in the two kind of observations we're making about where we are as a society is in both cases there's this interesting new ambiguous middle ground that has opened up, and in the case of Alone Together, that middle ground is partially opened up because the zone between, you know, private life and public life has gotten blurrier. It used to be you were basically a private person, or a vanishingly small percentage of us were celebrities or public people, and we lived in public. But most of us just had private lives, and the whole idea of, you know, kind of tweeting what happened at the party last night and potentially having thousands of people see it just randomly who you don't even know wasn't a possibility. So now what's happened is this space has opened up where suddenly, you know, it's not that everybody's famous for 15 minutes. It's that everybody's like a little famous, you know, or as I think Dave Weinberger said, everybody's famous to 15 people. And it means that there's a whole set of new conventions and new customs and new forms of etiquette that we have to figure out. And we're making it up as we go along because the technology is advancing so long. Like, I've had this thing where I'm mostly on Twitter in terms of my social media. I'm not really on Facebook. And I use Twitter as a public forum. So I, you know, occasionally talk about what's going on in my life, but mostly I'm talking about a book is out, or I'm going to speak here, or this observation about something I read. But recently I kind of cross-posted with Twitter onto Facebook. And my wife is on Facebook, and everybody she's the Tash Show on Facebook are just friends, and they're all just sharing pictures of their kids or talking about something that happened at work that day, and it's all a very intimate space. And suddenly, like, my tweets are showing up there, and my tweets, everybody else is like, look, it's Billy's third birthday party, and my tweet is like, I won an important award today, you know. And my wife is like, you sound like a jerk. Everybody else is, and I was like, no, it's just, whatever. And so, you know, the conventions are, you know, kind of being formed. So part of, you know, what we have to do in this kind of middle ground is figure out what the conventions are. But the parallel, I think, to what I'm seeing and arguing for with Future Perfect is that there's a similar kind of blurry, interesting new space that has opened up between people who were kind of inside an organization or an institution, like a government agency, for instance, and the people who were not. And it used to be, you know, you lived in the city, but you didn't work for, you know, the city of New York. But when you contribute to 311, you're suddenly in the zone where, like, you're helping the city, and you're adding information, and you're working almost like you've been deputized by the city to help out on some level. Or Beth Novak, who was part of the Obama administration, and is a big kind of emblem of pure progressive thinking in my mind, she created this patent thing called peer-to-patent, which deals with the major problem of reviewing the million-odd patents that have stacked up inside the federal government to be reviewed by these patent reviewers. And she created this program where anybody from the outside can come in and help suggest kind of prior art and help figure out if this invention is in fact new or not. And these are people just doing it for the hell of it, just doing it because they have some expertise in a field and they want to kind of help out, just the way Wikipedia was built. And just like 2 weeks ago, they made that open patent review applicable to every single patent under review in the United States Patent Office right now. So it's a big success. And again, it creates this interesting kind of third space where you're not quite on the payroll of the organization, but you're helping out. And it will create problems, and it creates noise, and it introduces, you know, whenever you diversify and decentralize the people contributing to a problem or to a solution, you introduce an absolute number more crazy people and more people with an axe to grind. But in the long run, if you kind of set up the system right, and these systems always take a lot of tweaking, you know, I think that widened set of contributions will lead to better outcomes and more efficient systems and more innovative systems for the reasons that I talked about. But it seems to me that that's a parallel there, that the technology is kind of blurring the edges of these older categories in ways that we have to really think about, because the edges are getting blurred so quickly.
I think one edge that's getting blurred in the minds of young people, where, again, my spin is less, is more cautionary, is in politics. I interview a lot of young people who consider it political participation to do a thumbs up or a thumbs down, or join a, you know, or be on a website, or, you know, who don't think, you know, who really think that web activity, following somebody on Twitter, being active in a virtual community, is political action. And again, my theme of conversation, you know, politics, and also the theme about the boring bits. I'm very stuck on it this week, but I mean, this thing about people talking about wanting to skip the boring bits of life is a very big theme in the interviewing. I mean, you know, what people say back to me about why they like the virtual is, it's kind of like, you know, it's like why you like taping television and watching it with your remote. You fast forward over the boring bits, and in virtual reality, you skip over the boring bits. I mean, reality has that. You can't multitask, you can't skip the boring bits. You know, really, and you know, I've been canvassing and you know, and going to states that are swing states, and it's, you know, really, there are a lot of boring bits. You know, doing that kind of politics has really a lot of boring bits. But yet, that really is what politics is. So doing politics on the web with thumbs up and thumbs down and Facebook liking and not liking, you are doing politics without the boring bits. But, you know, as a generation, I sort of feel that there's a legacy issue about making sure that in our enthusiasm for the exciting new spaces that the virtual opens, we don't have the courage to say, excuse me, there are all these exciting new spaces that the virtual opens, but hold on, there were a few things there are some parts in Stephen's work where he says there are some things that can't get done in the new spaces, and let's talk about those. There are some things that need the old way, and one of them, I think, has to do with some political things where it does take the boring bits. You know, challenging voter suppression, that will be a lot of boring bits that nothing in virtual reality is going to help you with. And in Stephen's book, and in his work, much to his credit, he talks about things that he thinks, will need the old system, which is why his book is quite nuanced and, you know, not at all kind of a blind,
Despite the fact that I moved to California.
despite whatever. I mean, it's a very, you know, right. it's not an unnuanced kind of, book of a pure technological optimist. It has, it is a nuanced book.
I think that, it's a couple of points on that. I think that, there's an echo there of the somewhat controversial article that Malcolm Gladwell wrote about the Arab Spring and to some extent Occupy, where he was talking about the history of the civil rights movement was that it was really driven by these strong face-to-face encounters when people were willing to kind of, put themselves in front of the fire hose. They did it with people that they built strong personal connections to. And that, big world-changing kind of movements were not likely to come out of the weak ties of of online networks. And, I think what he was saying and what you're saying there about kind of the boring bits and the kind of on the ground face-to-face nature of political change, I think that that's true in the sense of what has happened thus far, but it isn't necessarily true that that's the way it will turn out to be. It was much harder to build weak tie networks of collaboration during the civil rights era, and so there wasn't a kind of an alternate model that could form, and so they were kind of dependent on these face-to-face kind of encounters. Now we can have these weak tie collaborations, and to some extent, interestingly, Occupy, began as a hashtag. I mean, it was a hashtag on Twitter before, it was hashtag Occupy Wall Street for months before it actually was people actually occupying Wall Street. So we do have that. We know that just through it kind of bouncing around Twitter, it built up enough steam that it turned into people physically planting themselves in cities all around the world. So we empirically know that was capable of happening. Whether, we can use this technology to create even kind of bigger forms of change, and particularly to kind of solve problems, I think that's what we've yet to see, although I'm cautiously optimistic about it. The other thing that some of the folks in this room were involved in, which is very telling, was the backlash against the SOPA PIPA bills, the Stop Online Piracy Act, from earlier this year. And this, I think, is a really interesting case study in this peer progressive movement that I'm talking about, because we live in this assumption where we have kind of constant gridlock in Congress and in the Senate, and nothing can get done. The two parties hate each other, they can't agree on anything. The bipartisan support for those pieces of legislation was extraordinary. I mean, you had people from both sides of the aisle jumping on to support these bills, and you would have thought it was a bill to kind of support our troops. But it was, in fact, reining in the decentralized internet, giving corporations and government more control over the internet. That was the one thing the two parties could rally behind, right? And so what was very interesting when there was a big backlash, again, a complete weak tie backlash of people on the web who hadn't met each other in many cases, culminating in the Wikipedia blackout, a peer-produced site, and the bills were kind of dead in the water within a day or two. there was this striking thing in the news media where, you know, we like to cover these things in terms of horse races, right? So it's like, you know, there's a spectacular defeat of this thing that looked like it was about to pass. So who's winning? Who won? Was that a blow to the White House? Was that a victory for the Republicans? Was that a victory for the Democrats? And nobody could figure it out because there had been this kind of bipartisan support for it. And what it was really the people who kind of derailed that were all of us out there who believe in the power of these kinds of networks, who were organizing using these networks and sharing, you know, kind of support through these networks. And those people don't really have a natural home in either party. So they kind of, it was like this silent nerd majority that kind of appeared out of nowhere, and everybody's like, what was that? Where did that come from? And I think we're going to hear more from those kinds of people, and they are probably going to use those kind of weak tie networks to affect change, even though it's always better if there is face-to-face. I think it's not necessarily true that there has to be face-to-face for that to happen.
I was going to ask you, we're going to end our conversation in a few moments, then go to questions from the audience. I was wondering if you thought that there was anything, just to reverse roles for a moment, that you felt pessimistic about.
Well, I'm on really good medication now, so I feel very, I was born this way, I'm sad to say. Here's the question I have, which in all honesty didn't occur to me until recently, and it was actually with a conversation with my friend Eric I was just talking about who brought this up. As much as I love these kind of decentralized systems, and I've written about them on and off in some ways in almost all my books, but this is the first time I've written about them in a political context, the question I have, and I would love to be proved wrong about my worry about this, the question I have is, are these kinds of systems capable of long-term thinking? Because, you know, one of the problems we know about kind of decentralized market-based solutions is that they like to think kind of quarter to quarter. And one of the things that states can do well when they're run well is take the 10-year view or the 20-year view, or as my friends in the Long Now Foundation are trying to do, the 10,000-year view, which is pretty long. And, you know, the initial funding of the internet was partially, you know, kind of visionary. It was thinking on kind of long-term scale. And when we think about the problems we have in terms of climate change, when we think about the problems we have in terms of energy, our kind of energy dependencies, those are problems that are best approached on the 20-year scale or the 40-year scale. And I don't yet see evidence of people building peer networks that encourage that kind of thinking yet.
That's interesting.
And it's not that they can't. And, you know, one of the things I love about these things is they're constantly surprising us, doing things we would have never dreamed possible. Neither you nor I would have ever thought Wikipedia was possible 15 years ago, and yet here we are. It's there. It's real. But I think that's the part that I'm kind of most worried about, and I would love to have my worries assuaged. So someone, please work on that problem. All right. Should we open it up to questions?
I'd like to address this to Sherry. I'd like your thoughts on why people prefer the text, families prefer the text versus face-to-face conversation. Why are we flowing in this direction? And your suggestions about families don't text, is this like going against the current, that it's more difficult, it's easier to flow in the direction of text because people perceive it as easier?
People like to text because it can feel like a kiss. It can feel like a hug. Somebody's thinking of you. Somebody wants you. Somebody's reaching out to you. It's, my daughter before in the green room, I got a text from her. She loves it that I'm speaking at the public library. I mean, this is like an iconic place. This is exciting. You know, she always texts me before a big event, you rock, you know, go rock. And I hope I did. We have our little secret language. She wanted me to rock. It's a wonderful thing to get that text. So the question is not why wouldn't people want to text. It's more putting texts in their place. So what struck me so much about the texting during this memoir class that I teach was that people were telling life stories about escaping from the former Soviet Union, countries of the former Soviet Union, hard scrabble lives, abuse, sleeping in cars. I mean, really, and why were people doing it then? I don't think the issue is why we want to deny ourselves this seductive, delightful, instant gratification, fun. It's why do we want to do it really when it takes us away from our dinner companion, from the job we're doing, from really what's in front of us. And that, I think, is the distressing thing. And I think it does have to do with the sense that we're seduced by this sense of, it's like in Jane Austen, you listening for Mr. Bingley's carriage. You know, that's where the excitement might be. You know, that's where the new exciting thing that could happen to you in your life might come. People sense that it's going to come through their phone. That everything sweet and good and new of people reaching out to you or wanting you, it's going to come through that phone. So the transference is incredible to the phone. But I don't think it's a question of why wouldn't you want that. It's somehow why does the rest of life start to pale in comparison to that? And that's what I didn't see. I mean, that's my repentance. I mean, that's what I didn't see coming. As to the family thing, I think we just have to really begin to revalue what we have with each other. You know, it's that great recent New Yorker cartoon with a family standing at the beach and they're on vacation together and every one of them is standing looking at their phone. I don't know if you saw this New Yorker cover. That wasn't a cartoon, it was the cover of the New Yorker. That is my view from my beach cottage. I'm at the water, I look out, and people are with their families and everyone is looking at a phone. I mean, that is actually a snapshot of what, or hiking. I mean, you're hiking in the mountains and everybody, they're gonna fall off the trail. So I think that the issue is not that we have to give up our phones, it's that we have to sort of look up and be also in the world we're at. And I think the pendulum is gonna swing as we become a little less smitten and as we, take the measure of what we're turning our backs on. Would you agree?
Yes.
Only an hour with me.
No, I think that's right. I have more to say, but I want to get to more questions. Yeah.
Hi, Nick Grossman. So I agree with both of you. On the one hand, I think there's so much power in what these networks can do. I heard a story the other day about a kid in London who was writing stories about his life. He lived in the sort of hard part of town, and he wrote stories on this website called Wattpad, and he connected with people in other parts of the world, and it uplifted him, and it said that it saved his life, being able to connect with other people, and that's powerful, and that's real, and that's far away. I also have a little son who, when he was two, he could say, "Daddy, put your phone away." And so I get that, and we go to a lot of effort in our house to have dinner time and sort of manage that whole problem that you're talking about. I think one way of looking at this problem is networks make it easy for you to connect with people who are far away, right? And you're worried about what happens when with people that are close to you, make it harder to connect with people that are close to you. And my question is it a zero-sum game? You know, for every connection that I make with someone far away, am I necessarily taking away from the connection that I'm close to in the room? Or do we not have to think about it that way?
Well, the one thing that I would say that makes me feel like it's, predictably a slightly net positive in the balance of those two things is this. Again, thinking about the conversations we would have been having 20 years ago, one of the big predictions 20 years ago was that these technologies, the network technologies, were going to enable people to give up on cities and that no one was going to bother living in a big city anymore because they could all telecommute from their ranch in Montana and they'd get their indie records from Amazon or whoever and read local bloggers. And why would anybody crowd together in a city? And in fact, the exact opposite is happened. Cities have actually gotten more densely populated, in large part the the tech sector has thrived in dense urban areas, New York City being one of them, thanks to a bunch of people in this room. And I think it's because it turns out that the technology, while it can be a distraction in some face-to-face encounters, it also makes dense urban areas more interesting and stimulating because there's a lot of information in a big city that isn't in a small town or on your ranch, you know. But when you suddenly have the internet and the web and your social networks helping you kind of navigate through a city and discover things, suddenly that city gets much more usable and more interesting and more fun to be in. And so people are, in part because of the technology, choosing to crowd together physically more than they were for, you know, the age dominated by the technology of the automobile. So there is something here that is bringing people face to face. Now they are face to face and sharing physical space, and yes, they are, you know, they're in a coffee shop and they're looking at a screen and not necessarily talking to each other. But the importance of being around other human beings, I think, in terms of the patterns of development in cities, has actually seemingly gone up during that period, I think somewhat enhanced by the technology.
Hi, my question is for Sherry. I wonder if your research uncovered that distracted people are a new phenomenon. So I wonder if the people who are texting and disconnected with their families, if they wouldn't be watching TV 20 years ago, or just staring at the clouds while they push a stroller 50 years ago. Is it a new development with texting?
Well, I've looked a lot about this because obviously you don't want to have a kind of pastism where you idealize the past and create a kind of golden age when moms were just sitting around chatting with their kids and never read a book. So the question is, what's the difference between, for example, a mother watching television while her child is in the playpen and doing email while their child is in the playpen? And it turns out that, and now I'm forgetting the exact number, but so I'm doing orders of magnitude, that a mother reading a book or watching television looks up at that child, and not just during commercials, moves over, attends to it, brings them stuff. A mother texting, doing email, is like, goes into a space, and this is the thing we all know about what it's like to do email. It's like you think you'll do a couple of emails and then like five hours have passed. You know, it's like simulation is immersive. Going into these worlds is immersive and compelling in a way that reading a book or sort of daydreaming was not. So that I think that even though you don't want to say that you don't want to create a past in which, you know, mothers were glommed onto children in some way, there is a difference between a mother doing some reading while the children played and a mother literally sitting there ignoring the child because they're texting. My studies of mothers in playgrounds and the amount of attention the children get when the mothers are on their phones, if I had brought video to show you of what that looks like, I really think you would be, look up! You know, I mean, in a way that mothers just didn't do when they were leafing through a magazine and kind of turning the page, you know, talking with other mothers. So no, I think there's been some kind of change that I think is we should look out for.
I like everyone squatting so nicely.
No, I like it. It's so nice.
It's comfortable down there. I guess the idea of, say, like the arts and crafts movement coming out of the Industrial Revolution, are you guys seeing any responses to the digital age where people are sort of getting away from technology just to sort of like have more communities or build that community?
Yeah, well, we were just being interviewed by someone who's gone off the internet. I mean, I think people are trying different experiments. And, you know, one of the interesting things that's happening is this whole kind of movement of...
I'm going to sneeze, and it's going to be like really magnified.
Everyone, prepare yourself.
Prepare yourself. It wasn't
too bad. Oh my God! Well done. Totally forgotten what I was going to say. The interesting case for people using technology to try and solve some of the problems that technology is creating, right? And so there are all these kind of tools that people are experimenting with in terms of, one just single page mode on your screen, which is becoming increasingly common, where people are like, I need to black out the other windows. Just the fact that my email is updating in the background is this pulling my gaze towards it. And so I need to just shut everything off. And then there are these elaborate things. I mean, it's the whole...
Freedom?
Jonathan Franzen thing, right, where he like took the Ethernet card out of his laptop and disabled all connectivity so that he could isolate himself and write, a novel, which worked out pretty well. It's a pretty good book.
It's a program called Freedom.
I thought you were talking about Franzen and his actual book. That's so funny. I hadn't thought about that. Yeah, so there are things that kind of, I have to restart my computer until I go online and for me to go back online, forcing you to kind of get out of that space. And I think, we will see continued kind of experiments, whether there's going to be, an official arts and crafts or even kind of Luddite movement pulling away as a kind of a mass movement or as a subculture. I don't know. It seems somehow unlikely to me, partially because of the benefits we're talking about, but stranger things have happened.
As you were talking about the civil rights movement and the connections that people made and how they were able to affect change that way, and then compared that to the SOPA and PIPA protests, the question that comes to my mind is, when I hear about the civil rights movement, I hear about what a life-altering experience it was for everybody who participated in that. They went, and it's not just that they stood in front of the police and got tear gas, is that that changed the way they viewed the world, and it's a story they would tell their kids about the time they got tear gassed. And even if the SOPA and PIPA protests are just as effective in their immediate goal, do they lose effectiveness by being such weak ties, and is anybody gonna tell their kids about the time they signed an online petition?
Yeah, it's a great observation, and I think that's why I see it as the very beginning of something. I mean, this book, it was a fun book to write because in a sense it's a book about something that hasn't happened yet, right? It's a book about something that seems to be starting and that I see the little kind of tendrils of around me, but it's not something that is fully developed yet. And so the SOPA PIPA story is interesting because it self-organized into a movement that was strong enough to stop something. It did not actually create something, which would be better. And it probably did not leave that indelible sense of we changed the world and our lives will forever be, kind of marked by this experience. Does that mean that 10 years from now we won't have experiences like that, or there won't be major kind of issues that won't have been kind of tackled by this kind of movement? It's possible. I don't know. But just because there was kind of a very early first draft of these things doesn't mean that's going to be the end of it. I mean, Sherry has a great thing in her book about this conference she went to in 1978 to debate what the personal computer was going to be good for. And it was all the brightest minds in computing trying to figure out a home computer, what the hell are people going to do with this thing? And the kind of the range of kind of explanations of why it would be useful. I mean, you didn't mention this, but one of the big things everybody talked about was like home recipes. Like everybody will store their recipes on their personal computer. It'll be fantastic. And like no one did that forever until the web came along and people would get recipes. But like of all the things people did on the computer, that was like the very bottom of the list. So we're very bad at kind of anticipating where these things are going to go. And so all I can do as someone who tries to think about the future and about the way these technologies are going to help us or hurt us is to say, okay, here's this thing that is starting to happen. There's a chance that done right, if there are more people involved, we could have those kinds of transformative experiences, but we're going to have to work at it. It's not that the technology is going to just lead us to that transcendent kind of moment on its own. It's going to have to be us choosing as human beings to try and push the technology to help us to do that.
Well, I think that's where Stephen and I really are joined in our goals. In other words, that the technology, I'd like to say that every technology confronts us with our human purposes, forces us to figure out what our human purposes are, because it starts to unfold in certain ways, and then you have to say, hold on a second, are these our ways? Or are these the things that the technology is making easy? This technology makes certain things easy. It makes it easy because we're very seduced, for reasons that I don't know if I've sketched out the right reasons, for us to just kind of leave each other in the middle of dinner and, you know, go to other people. It seems to be something that we can avoid the conflicts we have with each other by just skipping out of all kinds of situations. And then we have to say, okay, we designed all the classes, all the classrooms at MIT are designed so that everybody can essentially leave whenever they want. Do we want our classrooms designed that way? It seemed like a good idea 20 years ago when you put in all this technology, but you know, right now, a lot of universities are saying, I don't think this is such a good idea. Why not take out some of that connectivity and have some seminar rooms where there's no, everybody's, the phones get put in a basket and there's no Wi-Fi, and we're just here to talk to each other. That might be an excellent classroom. You know, not for every, you know, for some purposes that might be an excellent classroom. So I think the point here is to, what I think we share is that we don't know how it's going to develop, but as we see it developing, it's still up to us to say, you know, let the people be in the driver's seat of how we want to use it.
I was wondering, in your research, if you've seen different behaviors with women and men. So like in sort of peer networks, in my experiences, one of my friends who's a developer, he puts it this way, and he says he was creating an open source thing, and he said there's the beards and there's the girls. And there, you can get the beards first, who are the free open source software developers, who are primarily men from what I've heard in talking with a lot of them. And then there's all these networks of women, like Aileen Lee from Kleiner Perkins wrote this article last year that like almost all the big social networks like Zynga and Twitter and Facebook, like the majority of activity was by women. And so I just was wondering if there's different ways these networks are working, and then also in your more like sort of private, intimate studies, if there's different behaviors that women and men are doing, and if there's different possibilities of how you see this evolving. I don't know if that makes sense.
No, excellent question. Well, you know, I think in terms of actually using the networks to kind of build things in terms of open source, it is, you know, heavily weighted towards men, but that is just because for complicated reasons that I don't want to get into, programming is heavily weighted towards men. And I don't think it's the kind of peer network nature of it that's causing that. Maybe someone else has a theory about it, but I don't think that. But, you know, it is one of these things where we have seen, you know, again, conversation we would have been having 10 years ago about the kind of gender divide in technology. And as social network software has become such a central part of kind of life on the screen, to quote the old book of Sherry's, I think that, you know, we've seen that gender divide has gone away. And that there is, again, for whatever reasons, we don't want to get into why this is, but there's something about that kind of collaborative social sharing network environment that women feel very at home at in a way that they don't feel as comfortable in a programming environment, probably because of gender bias and so on. But so I feel like when we build systems that encourage that kind of, that are built around that kind of network structure, not a hierarchical structure, that it's a very good environment for women to thrive in.
We've gotten a signal.
Are we getting a signal?
We're getting a signal.